You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Hello and welcome to 9 Plus, a podcast in which we discuss some of the research work that takes place in the Southeast Technological University of Ireland. My name is Rob O'Connor and I'm the host of the podcast, the proverbial guide on the journey as we seek to pull back the curtain and see how the sausage gets made. You can insert your own euphemism here. For our first episode of 2023, I sat down with two researchers from the Design Core group based in the Carlow campus, PJ White and Brian Casey. Both are designers and design researchers and very passionate about their field. We discussed what design actually is, what it means, why it's important, the role design plays in research, and how good design contributes to a more inclusive environment for everybody. If you think design is just about pretty fonts and colours, hopefully this podcast will change your mind. PJ and Brian were great guests and they described some brilliant case studies that bring the topic out of the abstract and illustrate through the use of practical examples, like PJ's research into how elderly populations heat their home, or Brian describing his research into biodegradable plastics. They were also eager to emphasise the humanity that goes into research, which is often stripped out when presented through formal conference papers and publications. Anyway, I began the conversation, as I traditionally do, by asking my guests to introduce themselves.
So I'll go first. My name is PJ White. I'm a senior lecturer in product design, SETU Carlow. Also research principal investigator and research supervisor at Design Core Research Centre. And externally, I'm an adjunct member at McMaster Institute for Research and Ageing in Canada.
So my name is Brian Casey. I'm a lecturer in SETU in Carlow in the area of design. And I'm also the core director for Design Core, which is the Design Research Centre based out of the Carlow campus.
Okay, I want to hit you with a big question at the start. And it's a very broad question, so you can really go off in any way you want at all. What is design? Who wants to go with that one?
I can start, and we can. It's a really good question to start off, and really kind of tough one as well.
We'd like to do that. Let's hit you with the hard one first.
Cheers, Rob. Good starter for 10. Well, design is a broad bandwidth of disciplines, really. And this bandwidth is becoming kind of wider every day and year on year. Traditionally, you'd see design broken down into disciplines. So anything from a product designer to a graphic designer, fashion design, interaction design, design engineer, etc. But this kind of widening continuously over the years and has been over the last couple of decades. And there's a blurring in between those disciplines as well, which makes things really interesting. Design is, I suppose, it's a creative pursuit. It involves creative acts, creative methods and processes that should broadly seek to make the world a better place. Mm. I know that sounds a bit trite, but that's what it should do. It's a creative practice of addressing needs or problems, and they're usually human or life-centred. And what we do is try to address broad needs within both economic or social, and that can extend to organisational, cultural or environmental needs. Designers can work on anything from a physical artefact to a digital system or a service, straight through to an organisation or public service. And good design can be in the form of a usable, intuitive app or domestic product, straight through to a policy or good design of a public service that is accessible and usable to a broad reach of people.
Yeah, to kind of pick up on that, to pick up on this idea of kind of good design. We talk about design, and we know what like a well-designed headphone is or a well-designed service is. But what does design, what's design separate from the object? What's design separate from the service? Mm. And it almost gets into, we're just laughing, are you ready for a bit of Plato this morning? It almost goes into this Platonic separation of the form of the good away from the object or the service itself.
So is that, you're talking about the world of ideas? So the idea horse and the actual horse, that kind of thing?
Okay, exactly. Yeah, yeah, so the world of ideas and design and quality are these terms that really exist in that space of this kind of the world of what is design, the idea of design. And when we get into it, we look at design as being the purposeful effort to create a new plan or schema. And when you look at it that way, you can see that all sorts of disciplines do design or have design at their essence, because they're trying to create a new thing, create a new knowledge, create a new... And it's very difficult, like you're laughing at the start, we're saying like, we're going to hit you with an easy one, what's design? But we recognise it when it's not there. It's very, very easy for us to see when design has been missed in any of the things that we use. And similar to quality, it's like that. When it's not there, you know about it. And we have a good sense, we have a good kind of intrinsic sense of what design is. But sometimes it's quite hard to articulate. And then we look at design. Design has to kind of manifest in the world as well. That's the other thing that's different about it. And Sir Ken Robinson, who I'm a huge fan of, he talks about creativity being applied imagination. And if we take that a step further, design is applied creativity. So we have to imagine it, we have to be creative, and then we have to execute on that and create something, create a new plan. And that's really where the rubber hits the road with design, that we're making this new thing, making this new knowledge, making this new plan or schema.
If you made an interesting point there, Brian, about good design, we recognise when it's not there, which maybe tells you that good design is almost invisible. And you don't notice it. You can just work with whatever the functionality is behind it. Now, okay, because of a computing background, we would see systems like that a lot. Like, say, computer programmers, and we tend to focus on the functionality, this is what we want to get X, Y, and Z done. And then we often forget about the user, the human, who's actually going to have to interact with the system. Yeah. Whereas, you know, it's like looking at a website. When a website is weird and hard to follow, people don't use it. So the functionality is diminished because the design wasn't thought about. I'm not articulating this very well because I haven't thought it through.
Okay, so this is at the very crux of it. Mm. And your example is at the very crux of it. And Dieter Rams, who's kind of one of the 20th century pillars of design, yeah, talks about design, like good design is invisible.
So am I right in saying he was Braun?
Yeah. And then also the other framework that we use a lot is Don Norman's Design of Everyday Things. And again, it goes back to this, that the good design, and the design is ubiquitous and the good design is invisible. We don't notice it. Mm. We notice it by its absence a lot of the time. And we see it in an awful lot of disciplines. Early on, they're completely obsessed with functionality and they forget about who's using it. And as the discipline matures more, computer science and IT is in this space now, as the discipline matures more, you start to figure out, oh, hang on, the user is important. I'm going to hand over PJ on this one because, like, this is what he does all day.
Yeah, I think the important thing that you brought up there is that design isn't just for designers, it's for everybody. Mm. And you should be designing for a range of people. When I trained to be a designer probably just over 20 years ago, it was about you're going to be a product designer and you're putting a pretty shape on something, or it's a pretty font or a pretty colour. Not debasing what I do or what we did, but the last 20 years, I suppose, it's widened out. And going back to your example of computing, that's where design research kind of came from the 1980s, when companies like Park Xerox were looking at GUI and graphic user interfaces, and bringing computers from industrial settings into the home. So home PCs, laptops, printers, different things like that, and making them accessible to people. So what I mean by design isn't just for designers alone. At that time, Park Xerox and companies like them brought in anthropologists, sociologists and psychologists to really understand what the needs were of people. And as a collective team, design for them, rather than just the designer putting a shape on something. So that's really important. And I think that's a movement that's been happening the last 20 years, and we continue to do that now, is to make sure that design isn't just about, I suppose, the creative act of designing, but it's that deep understanding of people, and that has to extend into different disciplines as well.
Mm, yeah. I'm going to hit you with an example just from something I can think of from back in the day. So I'm obviously into music as well. And I remember years ago, I didn't have any Apple products. I wasn't into Apple products. Yeah. You know, blah, 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 blah. I had a block about it. And I tried a bunch. I used to have a mini disc player, which was an old media format that was amazing. But it never caught on, okay, outside of a certain select group of people. And everything was moving to MP3. And I didn't want to buy an iPod because I thought they were overpriced, blah, blah, blah. And there's more functionality in other devices. And I bought two devices, one from a company called Rio, mm-hmm. and another one yeah. from a company called Creative Technologies.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Do you remember them? Yeah, yeah. 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 And...
You didn't buy a Zune, though.
I'd never got to Zune because basically, the Rio wasn't great. It was really difficult to navigate. It was very difficult to get music on and off and then to play the music that you actually wanted. And then the Creative device looked kind of like an iPod. But to play an album by an artist, you had to press about six or seven buttons to yeah. get into where you wanted to be. And it was just very finicky.
Yeah.
So, and then eventually I went with the iPod, and within two clicks you're listening to what you want to do.
And you looked at the mini disc there, and I have a few Musos in my family, so I'm familiar with them. And like the definition and lossless format and all of that, like, so that won out hugely over MP3, but the accessibility and with the genius of the work that was done with the iPod was it was dropping into an ecosystem. It was dropping into an environment where they knew what you wanted to do, and all of the ecosystem, the hardware and the software, was designed around you knowing what you wanted to do and getting to that quickly.
Yeah.
And it fairly shamelessly borrows from the Braun design.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
So am I right in saying, is it Johnny Ive?
Johnny Ive, yeah.
And he always, the only reason I know about Dieter Braun is because I've read about Johnny Ive.
Yeah.
And the kind of like the sleek blenders that you might see and things like that. Yeah.
The original iPod is more or less a homage to the T3 radio, which is a Dieter Rams Braun design.
Yeah.
But again, the difference that you experienced there was they took a user-centered approach to the design of that product.
Mm.
They looked at what you wanted to do, and they designed a product around that. And the other products at the time, and it's a great example, and we teach that example, the other products at the time were so obsessed with their functionality that they forgot about what you want to actually do is put the album on and listen to it.
Mm. Yeah. So to be, if I could be reductive about it, good design can lead to economic success, because who today remember? Like at the time, in the early 2000s, Apple weren't not a big, nor near the company that they are today. Creative would have been, I wouldn't say they were as big a company, but and Rio, I don't even think they exist anymore. But they all started from the same place. But one had a clear advantage over the other in terms of design that led to economic success.
Yeah, and I think the same can be said with companies like Nokia. It was at the time kind of like making something that was the sole remit of an expert and making it usable for a lay person or the general audience. And that's a difficult thing to do. I suppose what Apple did was made something beautiful, look beautiful, but also kind of made interfaces look beautiful as well. And that met the mental models of person that was using it, stripped away a lot of the bloat in terms of stuff that would and could be used, and made that workflow really simple and a kind of a beautiful thing to use and a beautiful experience to have, I suppose, as well. So it was about kind of creating an experience rather than around this complex technology and meeting the mental models of the person that's actually using it. And that was a really kind of a exciting thing at the time.
So when you say a mental model, What is that? What's a mental model?
I suppose it's how somebody understands how something works, and how cognitively they understand how something works, based on their own maybe learned conventions or how they understand the world. If your experience, you're a techie, so your experience of using probably the Rio and those other products was you could jump on board with that. Your mental model was quite intuitive and high to that, but maybe to a lay person that would seem quite complex, and then they'd lose all hope and not use the product anymore. Whereas Apple I suppose, stripped away a lot of that for a range of people, so they could meet that technological advancement with the mental models or the understand the cognitive load of the person that was using it.
Mm. So we're not going to turn this into a love-in about Apple, but it's a difficult one, it's the elephant in the room, certainly for in my experience anyway. It has been an example of design.
So the other example you talked about there, and it's uses a bit of a cautionary tale, but I think Kodak come out quite badly out of it, is that the kind of the Kodak and what happened to the digital camera. Yeah. And but the problem is that at the time, and I still shoot film, and my youngster shoots film all the time on my cameras. The resolution that you were able to get from a high-end professional film camera back when the digital cameras were launching, it was leagues above. And it hasn't been matched until the last 2 or 3 years. And even that's debatable. But what they didn't understand is how people would go on to consume the media. That the way people would consume the photography would change massively over the next 5 years. And as a result, they got caught behind the curve there. And so it's a key part of design, and not only technological design, but product design, industrial design, service design, is getting out ahead of what the user need is going to be and understanding what your user wants to do with the product. And we spend an awful lot of our time trying to understand what the user need is. And that's a kind of a key focus for us. And then we also have this thing you kind of alluded to there, Rob, what the human computer interface people talk about is the gulf of execution. So your mental model of how it works and how it actually works under the bonnet are usually completely different. But if the interface doesn't tie up with your mental model of how it works, you'll disengage from the product unless you really have to. Mm. And we would have known, because we're of an age, that early on, a lot of these computer interfaces, you had to work very, very hard because the interface did nothing for you. You know, so but you were prepared to put that effort in because of what the technology allowed you to do. So you were prepared to wrestle with the mini disc because it was a fantastic piece of technology and it did what you wanted to do at the high end. Mm. But we start to see that the consumer doesn't want that, or the user doesn't want that. The user wants it to conform to their mental model of how it should work. They don't want to have to go to the technology. They want the technology to come to them. And that's been a big change. That's been a big unrecognized change in design over the last 15 years, the degree to which the technology has had to come to the user.
Mm. This podcast is obviously about research. So, I mean, this is a very interesting conversation about design, but I'd like to tie it back into research because you're obviously both researchers involved in Design Corp, et cetera, et cetera. How does design contribute to research work and outputs?
I'll take that to start.
DJ, go for it.
I suppose, so design research can be a mix of both theory and practice, but primarily it's a practice-based research discipline. Professor Bruce Archer kind of calls design research and states that design research can be about practice for the purposes of practice and true practice. But I suppose, what does that mean when you're a design researcher? It involves a lot of, or should involve a lot of, making and doing, understanding people. And then there's your traditional literature review, systematic reviews, and getting a knowledge of, is there a research questionnaire? Is there a need? But we do that, we resolve that through making and doing. There's a lot of also reflection on what we do and reporting back. And we find that's incredibly important because design research is a relatively new discipline, and we need to be continually reflecting on what we do to inform future work and making future work and future research more rigorous. In terms of outputs, we have a vast array of outputs from non-traditional to traditional, and a non-traditional output, I suppose, in terms of science would be a prototype, a sketchbook, a visual, a piece of design ethnographic research, user understanding, user testing, an artifact, a garment, object. But then we have to work within traditional boundaries as well and produce papers and posters as well. So from the non-traditional to the traditional.
So design is a research discipline in itself, but it is also a research discipline that impacts on other disciplines. Is that fair enough?
Yeah. Can I come in on that one?
Please do. Yeah.
So we talked earlier about like the importance of design, and you kind of alluded to the commercial incentive to design as well. But there's a field of study that looks at human prosperity, but we don't know, we don't really understand what drives human prosperity. And design is very similar. We don't really understand what drives good design. But what we do know is that the conditions for good design are very fragile, yeah. That it breaks down, that you get a team together, you get an environment together, and suddenly you get this burst of good design. And that team breaks up or disperses, and that's gone. That moment is lost. So we recognise how important design is as a discipline, but we don't really understand how it works. We understand things that will stop it from working, and we understand a kind of a set of conditions that enable it to work, but we don't understand the actual creative process of design. And a lot of our research is looking at actually understanding the process of design so that other disciplines then can be more effective in their creative work as well.
So is design the application of art? That's a strange question.
Insofar as we talk about the art being that kind of creative leap or the leap from the imagination into creativity, then yes, a design is an applied version of that. But the art in a lot of these things, and like I have a science background, we'll talk about that later maybe, that there's a creative leap in science as well and a creative leap in engineering all the time. But that's hidden in their process a lot of the time. And design is actually a discipline, and architects have been doing this as well for years, where they reflect back on their process and try to distill out of it, where did that creative leap come from? And be honest about the creative leaps that are happening within their discipline. And so it's that self-reflectiveness. So I think to talk about design being applied art, I think neglects the amount of high quality design that happens in the sciences, in the engineering applications, and etc. Yeah. Because it also, and this is a thing I think that probably aggravates people working in those disciplines, their creativity and their contribution sometimes can get lost in their research outputs as well. Because we tend to sterilize our research outputs and strip out the actual, like we talk about ourselves in the third person passive. We strip out any of that. But there's a huge amount of creative work that happens there. And a lot of people, like myself, we were out in the wilderness in terms of having a framework in which to do that design and creative work as an engineer or as a scientist. And one of the things we can kind of contribute, I think, is to provide a framework for people to do that creative work and also for them to carve out space for that within their discipline.
It's probably a way of, I'm not an economic person, I'm not a nuts and bolts person, but I try to bring things back to that to maybe help me understand. So when we were talking about research and research outputs, papers, because that's the currency that researchers often work in. And I think it's very interesting what you've said there about the way we strip out so much of the work, because you might read a paper where somebody has done X, Y, or Z, but that has not captured all of the things that led to getting X, Y, and Z. Absolutely. And that's often where the real work is. The X, Y, Z bit is actually the easy part. You know, I'm thinking of an example, like say Aisling, who was in here last year. She's done a lot of work with men's sheds.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But she has told me, and she said on the podcast, that the big work was actually being accepted by the individuals in the men's shed, building up trust with them so that they would then engage with the work. But that can't be captured in a nice little survey that will lead to more work, you know.
Can I just say that I think design research is, I have to keep saying it, that it's a very new research discipline. And we are, I like to think we're research upstarts. And we're kind of we're borrowing from other disciplines continually to understand ourselves. And a lot of design research is understanding what design research is. So there's a lot of going in on yourself and understanding what it is. And then hopefully when we do understand ourselves, we can break the mold, because that's what designers and agitators should probably do.
Are you calling yourself a disruptor? Is that it?
No, absolutely not.
Sorry,
my boss is listening. So, well, you have to be. I think to be creative, you have to. You have to bring in you're well used to interviewing musicians. I suppose designers are no different in that creative process. Yeah. What is it? There's a part of yourself in it, but. To the opposite end of that is you have to bring in people and understand people. So there's that kind of self-agency and where you've come from, your lived experience and your cultural values and all that goes into your design and into sketching or whatever, or building a model. But then you have to be really cognizant of the people that you're designing for, their cultural values, their mental models again, their understanding of how the system or the service is going to be used in the right way. So, but like to understand how you design, that needs research in and of itself. And that's what we're trying to do. So it's trying to create what design research is, borrow methods, reappropriate methods or appropriate methods. But what's really interesting now is that we're finding that other disciplines are doing the same for design and borrowing methods from design, such as design thinking, design anthropology. And we're like magpies, borrowing methods off each other to find out new things.
People are always stealing ideas from each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the nature of things.
We just have to be honest about it.
Yeah. You talked about putting the human and putting part of yourself into it. So I want to go forward and talk about some specific projects that you have worked on, but I'd maybe like to go back and just find out where you're coming from as individuals. So Brian, we'll go to yourself first. What you've alluded to a science background or an engineering background. Mm-hmm. What where are you coming from? What's been your journey to get to this point? And I don't mean coming in here and into the studio and meeting me for a coffee beforehand.
Yeah, journey is a very 2020 word, isn't it?
Yeah.
I went to school up the road here in St. Paul's, which was a community college, and we didn't realize at the time, but that whole community college was actually a bit of an experiment. Mm. And looking back, you realise that the teachers that we had were actually, you know, firebrands in themselves. And also, you didn't realise how young they were when they were in with us. And that gave me a feeling that, like, there was a whole load of possibilities. There was a great openness to that. It had a real fresh feel to it. Now it was, you know, it was fairly cut and thrust up there, but it had a hopefulness and an ambition in there. But I was always coming from quite a technical background. I then went and did material science at UL. I transferred to Manchester University, University of Manchester, and completed my material science degree there. And then went out working in a glass weaving company in Dorset, in the heart of rural England, and there was, you know, doing chemistry finishes for glass fabrics that are going from everything from louvre blinds and almost like a wallpaper effect, right through to industrial processes where they're filtering gases coming out of. So it was a real broad spectrum of applications. Mm. And then I went back then and did orthopedic design and orthopedic materials. So I'm coming from a very science, by any kind of functional definition, I'm an engineer. I have I have all the papers that say I'm an engineer. And that's the background I'm coming from, which is why I'm quite passionate about this idea that, you know, the creativity and that creative leap in an awful lot of the engineering processes, that's there and it needs to be fostered.
So how did you end up coming into academia?
So I've kind of been in and out of academia, and that's the thing. I've been,
oh, okay.
So I academia worked for a bit, went back, did a PhD in biomaterials. Then out into industry, worked for, you know, a good number of years. And then I've got to the stage in my career where I'm thinking I want to make a contribution that's more than a narrow commercial contribution, even though that work is the work I did there is really valuable. I'm really proud of it. Mm. But I want to make a kind of a broader contribution. And with the kind of the the formation of the university, the technological university in the southeast, that I felt I could make really, you know, make a contribution in the region as well, which again sounds trite, but it's true.
You're allowed to be trite. It's okay. Okay, so PJ, what about yourself? Where are you coming from? What's the journey that takes you from there to here?
Well, I always loved making and doing from a child, and I think I always had a pen in my hand or a pencil and making and doing with my brothers and sisters. I knew in secondary school, I guess, that I wanted to become some kind of designer, but I didn't know what that would be. Went to a tech, similar to Brian, vocation school with vocational subjects, tech in Slievery in South Kilkenny, which is now gone. And I was doing subjects like that I loved, like art, woodwork, really hands-on stuff, metalwork, technical drawing. And in and about the time I was doing my junior cert and doing all those kind of art projects, I loved art. My sister went to do fine art in college in Cork, and I used to go down and visit her and look at the art students and kind of, these art students are having great crack. I want to do that. Because they were crazy and they were doing some really interesting stuff. Then kind of I did an undergraduate in industrial design in Carlow, so the course that myself and Brian teach on and research within, and it was just a natural fit. It was an extension from the tech. Hit the ground running, and it was technical drawing, sketching, making, doing, and it just consolidated all the things that I really enjoyed. Then after that, I went into industry, kind of like a design engineer, so the creative end of engineering and product development. Worked with some SMEs based here in Waterford, and then went on to work with Waterford Stanley Aga Food Services, designing cooking and heating products, and that was really, really interesting. Working first in the foundry and really understanding how products were made, and then kind of in the drafting office, seeing everything made from scratch as a team, sketching something out, and then seeing a prototype being made and being made in cast iron, seeing it being made on floor, which is an amazing experience. Then I kind of went on and started a sole trader freelance business, and then fell into academia by mistake.
There's a lot of people I've talked to fell into academia by mistake.
Yeah,
it seems to be a hole that captures many people. Yeah.
It was the recession for me, to be honest with you.
Okay.
And a position came up, a part-time lecturing position in Maynooth, and came up, and they were creating a new program, so I helped create that over the 4 years that I was there. Started a PhD, fell into that by mistake, didn't know what the hell a PhD was. It was far from PhD, I was reared, or like educated as well. So I really wanted to, I didn't know what that was. There wasn't many benchmarks in terms of what a design, particularly a product design PhD was, but I wanted to make sure that it was practical. And there was a couple of references in terms of practice-based PhDs, so I just brought in my whole experience of cooking and heating products. There's a brilliant department in departments of sociology and anthropology. I got talked to the people up there about what they do and how to harden up on kind of user understanding. I also got kind of fascinated around kind of aging and global population aging, and I suppose fed into my existential angst of what am I doing, where am I going, and you know, how am I serving the people that I design for, and what am I doing as a designer? Am I just putting a pretty shape on something, or how do I communicate or understand what the needs are for end users? So kind of start working within ethnography, and ethnography is a subset of anthropology, method within anthropology to understand people. So I went out with my PhD for a year around Ireland, within the homes of older people, talking to them about how they cook food and heat their homes for a year, about 40 people, older people. And that was fascinating. Then filtered that down into design work, sketching, and then I was told to stop doing my PhD, just write up.
Okay, right. So I'm hearing some practical examples there, and maybe how that is applied through to this kind of esoteric stuff is maybe taken into a project.
Yeah.
So let's talk about maybe some of the projects that you've worked on. Now, you've given me a list of projects here, and we won't be able to go through all of them because, well, we'll be here till Kingdom Come. But maybe if each of you could maybe talk about a particular project that you contributed to, that you were involved in a design capacity, research project in a design capacity, and maybe kind of what the outputs of it were, what you learned from it, how it contributed to the greater good, as they say. So maybe, so PJ, you've been talking for a second there, so Brian, we'll go back to yourself. If you just pick one project.
So I think the one you talk about, something that has a kind of a practical example, and one of the ones that we did a few years ago with Dr. Adriana Cunas Neves in Carlo, who's working on biopolymers and biodegradable biopolymers. And we did a bit of work there that was funded by SFI, where we were looking at the composition and the look and feel of the polymer, as well as its biodegradation behavior. But a lot of the work we were doing was understanding what people wanted from that material, in terms of, would they accept that packaging? Was the packaging looking right? Was it meeting user needs? And the design work. So Adriana already had a really good formulation, but it was looking at that formulation against what the user needs were, and realizing that some of the things in changing that polymer were easy to meet a user need, and some of them were hard. And figuring that out was a real kind of practical example. And that was...
No. I just wanted to ask you, like, maybe to just to take a step back. You're talking about polymers and things like that. I'm not exactly 100% sure what they are. So you're talking about packaging that might be involved in food. So instead of using plastic, that it's maybe something that's compostable. Would that be correct?
So, okay.
So you buy a punnet of tomatoes or whatever the hell it is, right? Is this what you're talking about?
So exactly. It's a case of we have a material and we have a process, and then it's finding the right home for that material and process. And then, so it's a biopolymer, it's a plastic, even though I hate that misuse of the term, but it's a plastic that comes from a biological source, but also will break down in nature, so will compost. And there's a lot of definitions around what composting means. And some of the stuff that we say is compostable only breaks down in a large, more or less industrial process, whereas some of it's home compostable. So it was discovering those nuances, discovering what people understood that to be and what was important. And then because we did look at various applications, but the one that came kind of screaming back to us all the time is the one you latched onto immediately there, was packaging. Mm. And we looked at packaging. Packaging serves a lot of purposes for the retailer. So you have to go upstream from just the user buying it. It has to get to the shelf in good condition. It has to be saleable. And then if we go back up the line, then we were looking at the production line. So I know some people who work in food production in the region. We went in, we looked at their production line and looked at what the implications of making some of the material changes would be on their process. So you have to understand your user, but your user isn't just the person who unpackages and puts it in the bin. You have to go all the way up the line, and then down the line as from where that goes from the composter. And one of the things we discovered was, if there's a confusion between a recyclable plastic and a compostable plastic, and it ends up going into the wrong things, we end up doing more damage because we end up contaminating what was otherwise a fairly clean and usable waste stream. Yeah. So it's helping us to look at the kind of the broader scope of problems, and then also looking at how people are going to react to it emotionally as well, how they're going to react to that product. And that's because we make decisions very quick as humans, and we post-rationalize something that happened emotionally and instantly, and it was uncovering and unpicking some of that was really important. And not only the people who are buying the product, but also the guys who are manufacturing. You take one look at it, and if they have a reservation, they make an emotional response to that. So it's managing that emotional response and discovering what the kind of motivations are for the user.
Yeah, that's a minefield. And that's the complexity.
And that is the complexity.
Yeah, that's the complexity. And that's maybe the work, is it?
It is the work. And it's also, referring back to an earlier point, it's the hidden complexity in a lot of these technical projects. Mm. And what we want to do as designers is bring that complexity to the fore, be honest about it, and also honour it in terms of how we're reporting on the activity. Because, like you said, we strip out a lot of ourselves out of these things. Mm. But there's a huge amount of emotional effort that goes in from any of the researchers in the university here into the work that they're doing. I think the way we reported those traditional research outputs, they do tend to strip it out, but there is a lot of there's a lot of emotional and creative work that goes into all of the disciplines here. Mm.
PJ, same kind of question to yourself. If you could just describe a project that you have worked with, and again, what the outputs of it were, the complexities of it, maybe how it appealed to you, just something that you think that's an exemplar in this area.
It's hard to think of one example off the top of my head, so I'm going to expand that and go for a range.
Go for it, whatever way you want to go for it. Go for it.
So I suppose, like, what myself and Brian are, and our researchers are, and colleagues are doing at the moment, is a range of design projects from social design straight through to industry-based projects, from a service to a product. And that product could be an app or a physical product. At the moment, we're kind of doing a lot of co-design work. And I've just like to narrow that down into kind of user experience. We work with Irish Rail. Our master's research has just finished up, works within Irish Rail, Fintan Kennedy, looking at door-to-door experience and understanding the needs of creating new products and services around people as they go about their journey every day, and implementing that into the rail service. In terms of health and ageing, which is my kind of specialist area, Brian and I have worked with the HSE and HSCP group, integrated care team in Kilkenny, looking at co-designing what integrated communication could look like across the service.
Sorry, what's that, integrated communication?
So as an integrated care team is a group of caregivers, and they need to communicate. They might be different from different disciplines or different, healthcare.
So would this be the idea of like the dietitian talking to the GP, yeah, who's exactly maybe talking to a physical therapist, whereas before they're siloed?
Exactly. Yes, okay, do a lot of that kind of work of making siloed activity connected. So we're finishing up that project at the moment. In terms of mental health, I'm currently working with Dr. Noel Richardson, who you've interviewed recently, in men's health, and co-designing interventions for suicide prevention within the construction sector, looking at particularly apprentices, and Jack is looking at that, one of our PhD students. In terms of ageing, there's a broad range of ageing-based design, from service design to product design. So as I mentioned, I'm an adjunct at McMaster University in Canada, McMaster Institute for Research in Ageing, and we're currently looking at work, an interdisciplinary project looking at ageing and the digital divide, and making sure that products and services are usable for older people. Our PhD, myself and Brian, and Jacinta Burndorn from psychology in Waterford, we have a shared PhD student, Trish Finnegan, who's looking at co-designing an age-friendly multi-campus university for the Southeast region, and making sure that, you know, the services that we create in this new exciting project are accessible and age-friendly. Also working with the German Centre of Neurological Diseases, currently looking at research, co-research with people living with dementia, and wayfinding urban environments.
Brian, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, no, that you touched on the point, and I think PJ highlighted again, it's de-siloing a lot of that work. And our other CERD scholar, Georgia Markham, she's working on transdisciplinary design and transdisciplinary research. So it's kind of using design, see if we can use design methodologies to provide a means of communication across those disciplines. Mm. Is there a shared language, a shared tool set, a shared framework? Yeah. that we can use to facilitate the transdisciplinary design. So he cheated. He gave loads of examples.
I took my opportunity.
The first example I thought was really kind of practice based and focusing on the artifact, whereas the other research we're doing is back to that thing we were talking about, like understanding what design is. How do you facilitate this creative act, and how do we facilitate this creative act across disciplines? And transdisciplinary means people with no discipline, and that means people in the community, people out in the factory, people in the workplace who actually know what they're doing because they do it for a living, bringing that knowledge in to what would otherwise be a siloed academic system. Mm. And so that's kind of at the really academic end of the research work we're doing is trying to understand those processes and how those processes can be useful. Now, the answer might be no, they're not, but it's worth asking the question. Yeah. And that's a very useful answer.
Or it might kick up more questions.
It usually does.
Yeah, yeah. All of those projects sound fascinating, actually, and it might be worth picking this up again, doing a sequel where we might maybe focus on an individual project and Definitely. Getting some of these transdisciplinary researchers together, and maybe going into the nuts and bolts of it. So we might arrange that for later on. But I'm conscious of time here, and imagine somebody was listening to this. Maybe they're a final year student, or maybe they're just somebody working in the foundry or in material science, and maybe thinking about getting into research. I think maybe there's something about this that would excite me or would interest me. Have you any bit of advice for a novice researcher?
Yeah.
PJ, go for it.
A few pieces of advice. It's obvious, but do something that you enjoy. And look, if it's research, look at an area that's of interest to you. And it's a unique opportunity to kind of explore an area that's of interest to you. I think look at the edges of your discipline. Because it's an opportunity to, that's the whole point, is to build new knowledge, and new knowledge is at the end edges of your discipline, so don't be afraid to go out to the edge of discipline to explore. I think practical terms is, start a conversation with researchers that have been there before, start a conversation with supervisors, pick up the phone, knock on a door, send an email, we're always there to listen. We'll say yes or no straight away or continue the conversation. But we're always accessible. I think we're an accessible group. So start a conversation. Also look at the practicalities in terms of time commitments that you have. To do the research can be time consuming. And if you look at what other life commitments you have as well. And also look at funding, how it's going to be funded. And that might be a conversation that you'd have with a supervisor as well, if there's funding there already. So I think it's important to have that conversation, do some research into what you enjoy doing, what area you want to push out into and to explore. Also, know why you're doing it and what you want to get out of it in the end. It's great to explore, but say in 2 or 4 years' time after your PhD or your master's, where does it lead to your next stepping stone? That doesn't have to be crystal clear. But use your PhD or your master's to break down into different stages and stepping stones into the next part of your career, if it's a career move that you're going for. So,
yeah, Brian.
So I think it's very important that you have to be interested. So I know of people who've tried to do a qualification just because they need the qualification or want the qualification. That can be quite a miserable existence. You have to want to know the answer to the question, and it has to excite you. So I did mine. My PhD was on bone graft. It was on replacement bone graft for use in surgery. And I worked a day in that 4 years because I was just mad interested in what we were doing. It was just really, I felt it was important work. It was interesting work. And it was difficult, but difficult and interesting is, we can do difficult and interesting. Difficult and boring, that's the work that's really hard to do.
It's hard to get them boring.
And I said, there's a Venn diagram, difficult, boring and important. And the one in the middle, that's the job you probably should be doing and you've been putting off for a while now. But I say you have to be interested in it. And then the other thing is you have to be very deliberate and purposeful with your time. Academia, time can just get eaten on you. and it can expand. So, and one of the things I kind of emphasize with our researchers and with our undergrads is tempo. Tempo. You have to be purposeful with your time, push to get the work done, and also be very deliberate with sometimes you push hard, sometimes you're working hard. And then sometimes you also need to step back and relax and let it expand, because that's when the ideas come. So that tempo, and particularly when we get started on projects, I think people are sometimes very slow getting started on projects, and that's a trap. So you have to push the tempo early on in the projects. Mm-hmm. But you have to be interested, you have to be keen.
To PJ White, Brian Casey, that's been a fascinating conversation. I actually feel like I could go for another hour, but we'll pick it up in a sequel. If somebody was listening and wanted to find out more information about you, is there a place that you would direct them? Brian, yourself?
Yeah, so it's the easiest way is drop me an email. It's, brian.casey@setu.ie. Drop me an email. I'll get back to them. I think trying to navigate our way through our online existence at the moment is quite difficult, where we're in transition there.
So. Oh yeah, the website. We won't get into the design of that now. That's another day's work. To be fair, I know there's a lot of people working on it.
There's a lot of people working hard. It's a big project. So just drop me a line directly.
Brilliant. And PJ?
Likewise, pj.white@setu.ie, on Twitter as well, at PJ White Design.
Excellent.
Find me on LinkedIn.
Brilliant. Brilliant. PJ and Brian, thank you so much. It's been a fascinating conversation, actually. I've really enjoyed it. And hopefully we'll get you a cup of coffee and back into the studio again sometime in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks very much.
Brilliant.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9+. We have plenty more episodes coming this semester. Keep up to date by following us on Twitter at 9+podcast, or you can find me on Twitter at RobO'Connor_IRL, on mastodon.ie at RobO'Connor, or you can email me directly via robert.oconnor@setu.ie. Thanks.